I'm happy to be introducing Marianne Baruch tonight. Marianne has been incredibly generous with her time during this residency, a generosity that I think is unsurprising given the carefulness and thoughtfulness of her work. Her poems are filled with images, specific and uncanny, everyday moments that, in her hands, are crucial to not only understanding our own lives, but understanding the world. During a small group chat this morning, Marianne said that poetry is not so much about finding yourself or your voice as it is about losing yourself. And we find that sense of self opening up into the world, into some larger thing, in poems like the title poem from her newest collection, Cadaver Speak, where a 99-year-old woman who donated her body to science witnesses her dissection by medical students. She describes the room of echo and stink, describes the students as too young to be stricken by the invasive procedure, and then wonders to herself, is it brave? What's brave? My God, how they walk into this place to begin with, all the ways and the smart ones, this must burn right through them. Marianne is the author of several other books of poetry, notably The Book of Hours, which won the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Prize. Other honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. She teaches at Purdue University and Warren Wilson College. So join me in welcoming Marianne Baruch.
You know, this is the coolest room ever. Let's say that. You guys are lucky. And you're all keep really trim with these hills, right? Anyway, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you for inviting me at all. And Jim is here somewhere, right?
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Oh, Jim and Marianne, of course. Hiding there in the Barrett's head. And you're really lucky to have these two poets here because they're both really wonderful writers, and you know, this is a terrific program. And I can tell because the poets I've been working with in workshop are just, you know, totally outrageous and interesting and talented, and it's been a delight actually working with you guys. We drove here from Indiana, which is what, 7 hours? And now we're wild and wonderful. Right? I love that. You know, it's not just wonderful, but you can be wild too. What a weird thing to have on your state sign. anyway, thank you. I'm just gonna be kind of promiscuous here and read around. You know? So. I'm going to read those. I've just finished a new manuscript, and I'm going to read from it, of course, but I'm going to read just four poems from it, and then, can you guys hear me? Am I drifting off? I'll read those, and then I'll go into the Book of Hours a bit, and then to the Cadaver Speak. So, okay. I got to keep time before you start throwing tomatoes at me. Triptych in Grief and Life Glad. This is in three sections. Triptych. One. I get sick of birds, like I get sick of jokes. Their punchlines ready to spring. And that expected luminous look on the face you have to mimic back. Like I get sick of the killdeer deer fighting out there on this vast lawn where I've landed like a Martian. Startled how different my language is, so keep to myself. Never attempting talk, even with the sad striped bird and the fury, those two in their battle. It's the big fancy one who wins. Thicker stripes, ferocious, the way his beak comes down on head and on feathers. Early morning, late afternoon, ground zero for their get on with it. Berries, insects with other ideas, twigs, fluff for the nest somewhere, mine, all mine. Somewhere was never Mars. So I came to Earth, and here birds deafen me with their cacophony, though I'm fond of the word cacophony. pauses that knife little hot air balloons. Exactly confusion, and the thrill nerve required of any utterance from the underworld. They're at it again. The sad one forgets he will lose, and I root for the sad one because we both forget. Two. Because we both forget, the girl I was, and now this grown older whatever, I happen on a thought. The thought takes a train north, or at once back to its box, thank you. The little chip for the soundtrack embedded up near the corner is faulty, keeps shorting out the Brahms when it rains. Okay, I'm not Martian, and I relish jokes. I loathe Brahms, someone told me the other day unprompted. A lot starts that way, inexplicable. Like the girl I was 50 years ago, oblivious in the plum tree backyard that flowered in May like some mad scientist's invention, spitting popcorn or tickets for the time machine. My mother loved beauty as brief. My mother loved beauty as brief before her one marvel, then another, then all of them lost. As for Brahms, I pointlessly pointed out he played cheap honky-tonk in a brothel in Hamburg when young. To be young, as if that could lift Disdain's 1,000 pounds, see, he could do anything. Later I thought, maybe just a tavern, not a brothel. Maybe I misspoke. Later I'm corrected back where I started, but so much isn't, or either. The sea air, the sting, since Hamburg is a harbor. Three. Hamburg is a harbor, but a city of bridges, someone happily warned me. More than Venice, she bragged. More than is one of those nifty devices to measure, like lunatics weigh the body before and after for what's gone, the soul, 3/4 of an ounce. In school, I pictured that almost an ounce, a tooth suspended, a stain under my ribs. Nuns told us you had to brush it. And midway through his monsters and his languishing, what if Keats did say soul making, the why life on the planet, first place, last place? What if those words, planet, soul, life, stopped right here? Then you are, in fact, from Mars, disbelieving, 0.0 amazed, the distant blue at fault, music's rise and drop, the deadly reverence over dumb things, quarrels to be at all. I can read and put it in real time yesterday, Russia and Stalin's freeze, one detail. The hard-boiled egg Mandelstam eats before they take him away, meant for another poet. That egg he roams streets to find, carried back, an offering delivered out of its roiling, gracious, on the table. But his wife, his friends, insist. It's kind of a weird one, isn't it? Better drink this. The paintings, you know, people do frastic poems about great paintings, so I decided to do a painting about a poem about a really kind of really dumb painting, like a really terrible painting. So, I mean, terrible paintings need poems too. The painting. Two brush stroke boats, so-so weather, more detail forward than aft. Heavy on shaded bits, simple reflection, the mass dropping in water blurred. Blur it more, bloom it up, says the teacher. Use a rag on something stingy. To look and look is all. Salt, fresh fish air at dawn, turpentine, or evening that one. To remember the past like this painting remembers, beautiful, a little dull, and maybe it was. In fact, water can turn out demanding, not staying put, too much at odds in that glitter. And people expect a quiet thing to hang on a wall to forget their own noise. That old guy bumming cigarettes for real looked the part of another century. The ancient fisherman contentedly mending nets at a time with time to retie knots, so we like to believe. And some would sketch him right in, work him over like an afterthought, historical. Better yet, to comment, ironic, but just short of it. With him, without, finally the worn, reliable, straightforward sea, harbor, dream. Also this, for the record, 3, not 2 boats. And those warehouses weren't pink, didn't watery ache like the shadow they cast. To be an artist, the best part, you're in, and then it's the same, but you're not the same. Smoke from a factory on the other side, a small one, but billowing smoke as soot and ash, anytime, a bad idea. Or a good one, meaning the world, meaning it could threaten or end. Go for larger, darker. The teacher saying so says, never an extra boat either. I heard things once, blurring out of sleep, or some other elsewhere, to none of us the same. The same what? After. As in between and among now for a long time. So I was raised Catholic, and I'm profoundly lapsed. So happily so. But anyway, I'm really grateful for that education. And so this is called Mudfest. And I don't know, did anyone go through Catholic school here? Okay, so this is for you guys. This is Mudfest. Some kid in the class, a boy usually, do we have to, sister? And the nun wants, no. She turned and slowly, no, you don't have to do anything but die. A room's hush is a kind of levitation. So the end of a rope phrase, so mortality presses its big thumb into clay early, sixth grade, St. Eugene's School, mid-century. It's a mud fest ever after. Free, yay, is what some heard, howbeit the gas primal, a descending and unthinkable click. Forget what she'd no doubt been programmed to say, as postscript, as speaking of. But we live forever, don't we, children? In God's sweet light, she didn't. Too old, too mean, too tired, too smart, maybe shocked at her own relish, her bite coming hard. I'm just saying there are charms on the bracelet from hell. An ordinary question, the boy's whatever it was, and did we have to? He was stunned. I could tell. And he must have walked home in the falling leaves distracted, disturbed, pushed off for a time from the anthill. As for the other ants, we had our work. It gleamed like truth is set to, in the dark before us. Grains of edible filth or just sand and splintered glass to carry it down. Okay, one more from these weird new poems. It's kind of a bummer, I think. Okay. This is called Mermaids. You know, this is not your lunchbox mermaids. But, no, really, mermaids are kind of scary. Okay. Well, you'll see. The mermaids. The spell is a mouth's perilous O as they dark circle the boats in their most resplendent, pliable armor. The concept fish aligning with girl, or love with death, to bring down men at sea, temptation confused into offering. The mismatch of like plus unlike really likes, straight to rock bottom. No equation has ever been this badass. It's the men who will enter the spell so far into exhaustion as weather, as waves, the tide pulling toward if, letting go then, over the whale road in the company of the dolphin, the only other animal, I'm told, who can do it solely for pleasure. It. You know what I mean. The lower half a glitter, the top half rainy, as beautiful it is sometimes. Murderous lovelies, they're plotting and resolve. And why not get these guys good? The lechers. To see it all in the whirling, to hear what anyone might in wind roar and faint whistle. Don't worry about girls, shrewd as windy, legend tough to the core. Don't. But it's their spell too, isn't it? Block there, a line was singing, dazzle, razor, black and green. Not that they miss what human is like, or know any end to waters half born to from where they look up. Men in boats, so sick of the journey. Men gone stupid with blue, with fast, with gazing over and away, the whole time until same, to same old, to know they're mean. After that, small. Out there the expanse, in here the expanse. The men look down, aching misalignment, gorgeous lure that hides its hook, steely sweet, to, oh my God, little fool's breath, triumphant, all the way under, and am I not deserving? Okay, those are the new columns. So, I'm going to read a few from the Book of Hours now, which I was saying today, and I was saying today in class that was the scariest book I ever wrote. I mean, I guess what I mean by that, it was the most profound experience I had writing poems. And these poems just kind of attacked me, you know. I almost don't feel responsible for them. But anyway, so this book is, of course, the Book of Hours is a religious, you know, it's a prayer book from the Middle Ages. That's the genre, and you know, it was their prayers for the various hours of the day, you know, matins and so on. The prayers were called, but also it was used for journals. People would write in like how they treated their animals and what they ate for dinner, and they used them as. So historians look at these things, I guess, now for just to see a record of how people lived at that time. So some of them were very beautiful. But the 99% had really simple ones, right? So, I mean, I would have such a simple one. So, these are all the short poems. They're all only 16 lines, and there's four threads that run through this book. One is the death of my mother. One of these are God poems, for which I'll be struck by lightning. The natural world comes into these poems in a kind of tooth and claw sort of way. And then there's the weird, like, voice poems, where an older poet, the voice, is kind of bickering and arguing with two younger poets. So, and I guess the thing you need to know is, and those of you who are birders already know this, but only the males sing. The females do not sing. It's a couple of species, I guess, who sing. I mean, the females, but mostly it's males. It's not fair, but there we are. Okay. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to read a few of these, and I'm going to just, the title is also the first line, and I'm just going to pause between them. I'm not going to do this little poetry patter thing, you know, between poems. I'm just going to go and do them. So, I lost my pen. I lost my keys, and my hat somewhere on a table. The table, its room, the field, its horizon, a road like a dowsing rod, bowed low to remember, emphatic and forked, that stick, two hands to hold the map that loved the place, spoke it day or night. I lost in a cellar to dark and dank, where sun tried for one window, very small and lost. Over a sink whose water never knew or kept losing the simplest reason for coming and going, no way from the blue or the deep to bring back a cup of it but a flood. My mother's body to wires, to tubes in their liquid days, she turned toward me or away. Winter, but so much sun from car to door. I followed it past nurses at their station talking movies. Who's good in one and not the other? Gown tied at the back and neck, she slept beside a window. I watched my chair there reading, looking up, reading. Who knows what I read? her legs bruised, thin, arms battered by the doctor's needle. Her face. Can I say this plainly now? There was life as she grew less. She drifted to it. I'm not hungry, not religious. I'm in a spot, she told me one afternoon, then closed her eyes to that radiance again. I don't know, he said. I guess it's something I'd like. An ocean with such ugly fish down there, dark ones with barbs and lantern lights affixed to their heads. It's all I got, said the voice. And this wetsuit to go with it, this backpack of oxygen, this camera, this knife. Be careful. The poem's tough, but one minute it goes delicate on you, it could dissolve. I don't know, he said, one leg pushing in, already one arm. Like his old First Communion suit, white, even the carnation, the heat that spring, wilted smell of lilacs. Be almost hypnotized, the voice said. Remember, punch holes at the surface. A little breath. What a box. It includes the butterfly and the rat, the ship drying to chalk, trees falling at an angle, taking those moist and buried root balls with them into deadly air. But someone will tell you the butterfly is the happy ending of every dirge-singing worm. The rat, a river rat, come up from the shimmering depth. The ship passed purely into scat. One can read for a source, the creature that shadowed it one longish minute. And trees, of course they wanted to fall. It was their time, or something equally sonorous. And wind, too, knows its mindless little whirlpools not for nothing, not nothing, that pitch and rage stopped. How else does the sparrow's neck break? I am so pissed, said God. Maybe I'll invent happiness. It was a blur at first, but it got bigger. It sort of hovered, wanting to land, on what, God said, to whatever wasn't bright and brought out of nothingness yet. Oh, that nothing at all, so beautiful. It took God's breath away. Was it breath? No, something else. How long before happiness turned bluish, restless, trying to cancel itself out? Should I invent time then, said God? Maybe the problem is this summer thing. Maybe trees get sick of their green and their whispering. Happiness, said God, welcome. But stand over there, over there, over there. In the hospital parking lot, the huge perspiring priest opened his trunk and gave me such lemon, enormous, absurd. Everyone said I was mistaken. Everyone later not believing, you've got to be kidding. Then, really, lemons, when I held one closer, the driving scent of it proof. You know, we all die, he said from the car, from an open window, almost an afterthought. In fact, it was a cool day for Florida, even in winter. A little coolish, that's how my mother would put it. So big deal. So you find it sort of sucks, the voice said. Fine. Go out to your regular life where they pay you for doing something. The poem's okay in that pile of old papers. You'll see how you'll empty the day, be back, and open the door. Keys, even useless ones, have a rattle. Am I sleeping or writing, she said. What comes when I call? Does it matter like love matters? Is it sleep who writes, or words that sleep? Her eyes had closed, so many things not clear. Because I keep telling you, the voice said. It's not like a person at all. Say it comes like a cat. Then give up on dreaming. The suffering of the masters, Chekhov wrote, affects the entire household, even those who work in the garden. Which is to say, I open his book, and my eye finds that. Like I found a window once, looked out to a car, a guy bent to an open door, sullenly arranging, rearranging, for a long trip. Chekhov was hot, she tells me. And we stare into his picture on the cover, short hair, a new beard gone slightly ragged, a young man absolute and hesitant. Equals hot, I agree. Equals something. It's like we know him, I hear myself. Like he lives around here. Which is to say, they keep fighting in the story. I open to another line. Leave me alone, I beg you. You say you turn off the jet, said the voice, and poems keep coming? Clever boy, I've heard of that. It's the Holy Ghost stuck in his pajamas. I just want to sleep, he said, god-awful flood. Not even a spoon to catch it. Anyway, it's nonsense, gibberish. Some gear losing a tooth each orbit. No mishmash allowed, cried the voice. No thingamajigging. And Chaucer never spelt it right. Sutta and that pirsa to the ruta. For once, please, he said. And the voice, okay, let's see. I know you have a big day tomorrow. And you love your bed. Birdsong faceth some male machine gone addled. Repeat, the damage keeps doing. The world ending and starting. The first word, the last, etc. It's that etc. How to love. Is a wire just loose? Build an ear for that. Fewer, they say, so many fewer by far. He's showing off to call her back, reclaiming the tree, or a complaint, the food around here, the ants, the moths, the berries. She's making a nest, or both are, in feathers, in hair or twigs, in rootlets and tinfoil, shiny bits seen from a distance, a mistake. But fate has reasons to dress up. Stupid and dazzling have a place, though never, she can't see it. Okay, so those are sample from, you can see how they were scary, right? Like when I wrote that, how else does a sparrow's net break, you know, like that? Scary, man. Okay. All right, so I'm going to, you know, read something to never speak. I think I've said this before to people, but this cover, which shows three saints from the second century, famously beheaded here, holding their heads, and the great story of these three is that they were martyred, of course, and they were apparently, so goes the story, their heads were cut off, and they got up, bent over, picked up their heads, and walked uphill looking for a place to bury them. Isn't that great? Just clean up after yourself. Anyway, of course, my great hope is that they buried their heads in this book, but, you know, I came a little later, so. So I'm going to read. So the first half of this book are poems that I wrote, and the second half are the poems, the title poem, Cadaver Speak, that my cadaver wrote. So first I want to read just a few from the first half that I wrote. Okay, so you guys okay? Has anybody ever flown from Alaska? Put on those red eyes and come from out Anchorage. Seems like they always go at night, you know. You've been on night planes though, where people are sleeping and they're all like, you know. It's really weird, you know, people passed out. Wait, like, this is the ghost ship or something? You know? Face. A winter's long red eye out of Anchorage, small lamps near the floor made grainy, blurry everything, which meant awake, then almost, then head slipping back to the side, mouths jarred open. There are words bodies vanish to, curved, slumped, relaxed, released. And a sound, not the underwater lament of the whale, not its distant need to you, don't even imagine. I heard no sad rattle from the human throat. Only the loose tick-tick of it, seats 3A to 10C. At last, the whole cabin caught in night's breathing, a dark sandpaper at work, stopped to start again. The fact is, I walked through an underworld that aisle. I was up, had to, and saw in the dim, not yet dawn, the arms and legs of Shiloh and Gettysburg flung every which way. Then past that easy horrific, those strangers merely out, gone out, curled to each other, love in the abstract, love how it never comes on purpose, no one arranging a face to please or to frighten into love, just a simple forgetting who is who, and if ever. Like children don't know the most troubling thing about themselves, won't for years, or like the dead who could, but can't tell you. For once I stared everyone right in the face like it was my shroud and my leaving. I keep thinking like, but my saying nothing at all had so little to do with it. That one time my grandmother didn't say where we walked, took, I was taken, thrust forward to meet the old blind woman, her hands to find me and that child. Great length and breadth of her, bent as if to some odd angled stone on a beach, so foreign, so much a place I'd never go. Her barest touch on my cheek coming such a long way to my chin and lips, the ridge of my nose, my closed eyes. I opened them to her face, most private part of the body now, usually calm. The kindness suspends and lets go, her eyes blue in their milky drift regardless, looking not anywhere, but straight into this, no end to it, flying over a continent of ice and sleep and ruin and light. So I have to introduce, I think, the whole thing that got this book started. As was said earlier, I teach at Purdue University, and they have one cool thing for faculty there. You can apply to study something. It's called the Faculty Fellowship in the Study of a Second Discipline, and you relieve of your teaching to study something completely unrelated to what you normally did. That seems to be the requirement. So you sit around and think, that's really weird, you know. I mean, anything is weird next to an English department. But of course, the English department itself is fairly weird. But so I applied to be in the cadaver lab, gross human anatomy class. It's the first course for medical students in the medical school. And also to take life drawing in the art department. You know, it had kind of symmetry. It's kind of a cool idea. But then they gave it to me, you know, so. You know, you write these things, you never think you're going to get them. So. It's kind of a shock when you get them. Anyway, so I did that for 6 months, and per semester, that is, because that's 6 months. Anyway, and you know, cadaver lab was 12 hours a week. Just that course. And then, of course, you all know, or maybe you don't know, that you know, studio art classes are twice as long as they say they are. You know, supposedly they're 3 hours, but really they're 6 hours. Yeah, surprise. So, you know, so I was in class a lot, actually. Anyway, so I'm going to read this piece. This is like from my point of view, and sort of an episode in the dissection lab. And this is called Souls of the Dead. My grandmother, her oddly accurate euphemism, turning up to the doctor. She meant caught in stirrups on the examining table. A doctor warming and wincing his speculum to eye the most interior goods. It's just that in lab, they're tying open the legs now, cadavers of supine. They're pulling them to the end of each table, knees roped sideways. I am so not doing OB-GYN, the most brooding first-year med student is shaking his head. Like I can't believe I'm writing this word by word until I can't believe I'm writing about this, stares back at me from the page, mildly unthinkable. Narfia, the anatomy TA, we try to be so respectful. It jumps gender, it's equal opportunity. The male students put off dissecting the penis. Just another thing left to women, one of the women blurts. Like we want to. My grandmother had her other roundabouts, a tablespoon of bourbon in the pantry each afternoon late, her pick-me-up. As for my sponge bath, I was to wash down as far as possible. Don't forget possible, she'd stage whisper outside the bathroom door. At the museum, a small thread cross behind glass. Back dimmest, whatever it was, to capture bad spirits against the slow rise of a mantra, set just the right way. A trap woven at the roof for the entry of anything to keep safe, to ensnare. We bent to my favorite, the 99-year-old. I told her, this won't last. Sure I did, sure. In the Great Pyramids, the Harpy tombs had sirens, female-headed birds, really jars and secret, holding the souls of the dead who peered from all four corners. Just want to read one little more, and then they'll go into the cadaver sequence a bit. This is called Practice Saying. So practice saying, my name was? What exactly? And why did I live? Then those words the poet, the quiet one, puts into a mouth. Spit them out. Not all of us get to be ghosts. A few still need a good Googling, or the Ouija board sitting level on knees to ask stupid questions. No matter, we'll all telepath into the ether. Will we be another species then, strange and endearing as a cat that talks incessantly? I had one time, a little much, but such sweetness, her insistence, her wanting to tell me at every turn. What a puzzle death becomes, rainy afternoons, to put who we were back together. Certain poems begin with a pine tree in the middle, or a bird yet to be found in any Peterson guide. Good, that's great. Call it in life or of life. Before and after rolls into one giant look down upon the well of all being. Here, you know where that is? Little dot on the horizon that isn't a well, isn't a man walking home. Okay, so as with the Book of Hours, I'm not gonna stop between these sections. This is a 32 section poem. We'll be here till 2 in the morning. Let's read a few. My speaker is my favorite cadaver. One does have a favorite, in the cadaver lab, it turns out. So, and she was, quite small, and she, that's just great, really. So I'm going to just jump around and read to you. I think I didn't tell you anything except the quiet one is me, and she hates me. But she likes everybody else in the cadaver lab. She likes the students, and she likes the anatomist, the teacher. She has her issues, as they say. Me. Okay. So I'm getting, these are numbered, but I'm going to begin with six. I'm not going to say the numbers, but just jump around. What to hate? I'm going to tell you one thing. That the cadaver, at least in America they do this, they wrap the heads. They wrap the heads with towels, and then they dissect the body. They dissect, everything, and then they take off, it's a big deal, they take off the towels. And you see who you've been working on, for many, many weeks. And so, she complains about that. What to hate most? This mummy way they've wrapped our heads, thick wet towels close in orbit. Or the distant shock of it, I half love, the pretense that they've blinded us. So they can work, of course, without our staring back. Work, first taking down and out what's left of us, gristle by gristle, siphon to sprocket. There's silver probes in those empty bits, all new words, my fossa, or is it fossae, where the edge of bony things once fit. Only they see what's pooled there. But it galls me that even my dismemberment, so predictable, my back where they little windowed out my spinal cord, then the slapstick flip right side up to shoulder, arm, hand, on to plot my middle kingdom, liver, spleen, down to possible, my mother might have said, shooting me that look. Nearly a century on Earth gives a person permission to be crabby, but not an idiot. When people write, I like sentences that turn sudden, unexpected. But that didn't happen to me. I gave away, then wore out my ending. When my family talks, the usual blah blah goes on. Generous, it's such a good long run. But I never ran, not ever. I did go to college, nothing fancy, one of those normal schools. I was proud of that, smart enough, up from the one-room schoolhouse, the old story, the girl off the farm, sort of a rarity. It wasn't exactly. I liked words. I liked to read. Aesop's Fables, Hausmann, Frost by Heart, the story ones especially. I loved metaphor, though nothing's really like anything else. I loved Trollope and Dickens, not Jane Austen. She lied. Things don't mainly end best, though there's a chance with better. I taught school some. Didn't care for that, no. You have to be bossy. You have to be certain about stars and how words rhyme, how dollars cartwheel up and over and again to make Johnny rich. I just kept reading. So what's this fellow got to say all the time, my husband said, holding my frost to his ear, shaking it like a box a voice might fall out of. You should write your secrets too. No secrets, I said. But I thought about things alone and eyed my girls like a scientist as they grew, if too much sleep would make them stupid, if their quarrels were tied to weather, a beautiful day and its boredom until the flash and spark of one simple meanness bloomed sharp between them for a change. Change means what happens in secret. I happened, they happened, she, he, it happens, a day, then the next day. Oh, to write the way people do. The things they leave willy-nilly at the end of these tables the morning has gone. The breast they cut from me to worry the milk glands. Those tiny wires one daughter turned from, the other took with her beautiful greed. My husband's greed was sweet and fierce. He hid it in the dark. That I miss. Of course, the four of us, we died, didn't we? Gone months before anything happens on these tables. We had names someone might still say in passing, might think before bed. Is that solace? 99 years, I'm small. One of them touches my shoulder and her hand stays there. Then I'm smaller. Smaller than my grandmother who curled like a fish every afternoon nap, too wry and lugged for one life. I watched from the doorway, followed her spines knotted half circle in that blue cotton dress. Identify, appreciate, move on, this teacher's good mantra. And if I can't move on, or she can't, or he can't, or any of us, or all of us. Well, have we appreciated enough, says the med student Josh to the med student Ajit, staring down the start of my vagus nerves, flat, white, endlessness. From the brainstem south, its journey famous and fabulous, radars out to ear and lung and heart, all various mad viscera in my lower distance. Vagus, longest run in the body. I understand these things now. I am these things. Never poor little nerve, from the Latin to wander, thus vagabond. And there's vagrant. Same root of old when gods walk the earth in disguise. Ordinary, vague enough. You know me. You saw me in the shops, on the street, in the dentist office. The dentist. Thank God I'll never do that again. I was the old one who made you crazy, picking up every apple and putting it down. I blocked the display on watches, their little faces silver or gold, because I couldn't decide. Next to me, not the giant, it's the last of us on his back, too. He opens like a box cut down the middle, flaps made to pack him up when the day's work stops. They roped him hard every which way to turn the hand so they could do the hand, and almost broke something. And now when the whole get-up gives or slips or whatever rope does, his arm drops to any old arm in the world thrown off in sleep, off the edge of that shiny table, like it's a bed, like he just turned over because his wife poked him. He was snoring softly, but way too loud for her. She had a dream to get back to. Such a human gesture. Who wouldn't look twice at that arm, blinding half second? You would too. I mean, the dead know the ways of the living. The air in this lab, the thing they talk of, I already said not great, and it sticks to their scrubs and their hair. Me, my rot at the heart of it. Not my fault. I soak months to clean up. And here, every late afternoon, before I'm plastic-wrapped for the night, they spray alcohol and water and fabric softener all over this body of rags strewn out on the table, my flag of no allegiance stripped to a zillion bad colors between worlds. I'm so many pieces. But this new trick of the elements, passing into ether, once stars and planets famously made from it. So, I'm at this party, right? Says the med student Claire, and oh my god, I smell cadaver on me. I'm like that now, secret, loyal as a whiff. So they do, they skin the faces, our faces. Really a mask then, was it, for years? But to change that, to make us beautiful again, the quiet one puts a metaphor's distance between. No, she says to anyone, we're just shaving him. Or it's just their negatives of themselves now. Everything reversed for a moment. Meaning, where light should be, bone gone out. Or how can I know? She's already that one. Delusional. But the first of us, the finger polish lady, morphs to what they'd show off in a gallery or some glossy book. Only half of her skin, little half mouth, half nose, one eye and cheek down to its x-ray. The other side they forgot or got lazy, had reason, still full-fleshed pink. Was I ever that pink? She is beautiful. One artery at night, how it throbs straight from the heart, so close to my ear to keep me awake. They pulled that apart. Not a head, a skull. Not an eye, an orbit. But the truth about negatives, ghosts behind any photograph, fixer, stop bath, once pooled, two little trays, a bluish half-light in there. Could be it comes again, watery, unspeakable, and I'm back to myself. The worst is ancient, a chant or a charm. They took off our heads. If I had to write that most balanced, simple sentence, I'd need the steely posture I never had. What hard work. It takes time. Not for nothing they invented the guillotine. One of them here, Gita of the lovely black hair, hacked away so dogged and never glanced up. Look, even the tough, worldly one who figured out in seconds what nail polish that was, rose, madder red, she stepped back. Then I knew it was way worse than the rank yogurt mess they found in one lung. Certain minutes pass, go stark, you count forward and slow, and you breathe. Oh yes, my head jiggled loose. Broke off the stump of my neck, most medieval, unbearable fury, lean in for the drop, but no one threw it. And now here, the never will be was, which is to say the rest could be said by anyone, I suppose. Past tense for not yet is oh that, for today, last week, last month, yet another Wednesday shot. There's spring because of winter. Before that, fall back into summer where rain links sun like some split-second lurch in the car. Past tense of window is close at such weather. Past tense of pain is sleep through the night. Before, cut here, sew up, cauterize, you smell something burning, is rot, is wound, is cold, then colder. Before war is war. Before peace, more Lord. I waited, I worried, was my bloodless lot. I remember the stopped heart, and before nothing you'd noticed, that nothing on and on, huge in years, weighs about nothing, like a whistle sweet, because it's distant. So many meant well, telling me God, God this, God that, like they know. Well, I never knew. There's the body, there was a body. What they found in me in that lab is proof. Past tense of me, by the way, is she, a woman who lived. Where was that street? Who worked on the farm, at school, in the dirt, at a desk, in the shade? Who read, who forgot what she read, who drove home after so many deaths, too fast, too slow, the last corner, the house we once, and once I wouldn't get out of the car. She, who played not one instrument, even badly. Past tense of past drifts into ruin or myth, or did it happen at all? I won't even ask. I dreamt, same as you do. I did. So, thank you. So, if you guys have any questions, yeah.
What gave you the idea to write from the cadaver's point of view?
Well, you know, when I started writing this, what's weird is, I wrote this, and when I first started writing it, I was like, I am the poet in the cadaver lab, you know, these are my thoughts, you know? And, in fact, the first version of that first poem, which I didn't read, but the first line I had written originally was, the body before they opened her, the darkest dark must live in there, where color is wasted because I hear them look and so on. Because it's very colorful in the body, by the way. It's, you know, the yellow, bright yellow fat and the Kelly green gallbladder. And it's all this color. And you're thinking, why? You know, like, it's all in the dark. Anyway, so I wrote the first couple of sections and I read them to my husband, hiding back there. And I said, so what do you know? He's like, And I realized, you know, it was like, I was trying to, like, it's me, you know, having my revelations in the cadaver lab. I thought, that is so boring, really. I mean, I should be thinking about this cadaver, right? So I just changed it. I made that one change. The body, and this is the way it reads now, the body, before they opened me, the darkest dark must live in there. And as soon as I did that, it was sort of electrified for me. It's like, and I'm a person, I don't even like persona poems. I think they're kind of, I never believe them. You know, when someone's like, yes, I am Lewis and Clark. I'm like, yeah, right. You're sitting in your suburban house writing this. Okay, so I never would have believed that. But, you know, as soon as I did that, it just like, and then just kind of, I had all these notes. I took in zillions of notes and stuff. And so, and then it kind of wrote itself in a way. I mean, I really whacked it out, you know. And I revised like hell. And I started thinking, I think, I imagine, although I'm not a fiction writer, but who writes fiction here? Probably a lot of people, right? So I begin to understand why fiction writers really love their characters. They like to hang around with their characters. They'd rather, you know, just grab a sandwich than get back to sitting with their characters and thinking about them, right? So I really began to understand that, in a way, in my limited fashion as a poet. But, you know, she kind of grew on me. But I didn't want her just to be, make her like, you know, a little mini me, you know, like a smarty pants college professor pretending to be a cadaver. So I had to like, but this generation read a lot, I know this, right? And although they weren't, you know, super well educated, they read all the time, they memorized poems, you know, they were quite literate in this way. And so I could count on that, I think, to make her credible as a speaker. And you know, she turned into kind of a smart ass. But she has her tender moments. So I really tried to different sides of that. And a lot of these things I quote from the students, I mean, they were saying these things. Like I was in the girls' john changing clothes into my scrubs, I heard that girl say, I was at this party and I smelled cadaver on me. Yeah. You know, I thought, whoa, my God, this is great. So, which is my experience. You know, I leave there, I go to a faculty meeting, I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, I smoke Cadera on the interview. So, anyway, so I just, I want her to do it. And, you know, she really wanted to, what can I say? But, you know, it was such an interesting experience, sort of. And when I read this, and I'm sometimes people say, well, you know, I feel like she's hovering between life and death, kind of figuring out the whole mystery of it, you know. And I purposely did not make her religious. I didn't want to go into those kind of stock treatment of this, this thing. I wanted her to be her own person. So, but yeah, I mean, it just got totally out of hand.
Getting attacked by the
poems,
and it was scary.
Oh, Book of Hours?
Yeah, Book of Hours. I was wondering if you could just talk about that process a little bit more.
Well, you know, I'm always, I sort of didn't do this with Cadaver, but mostly, you know, my whole theory of writing poems, I call it the begging bowl method, where you just put up your begging bowl and stuff drops in and you work with it. You kind of go blank. So, I've always done that, but with this book, you know, the Book of Hours, this thing is just, I mean, it just came up almost whole cloth, you know. I did revise them and stuff to work on them, like one through several revisions, but not in super serious ways, you know. I don't know, it's like they just, and it's the only time I've ever really had a form, you know, they all kind of look the same. Which is not the case, usually, you know, I'm into that thing that most of us are into, like, oh, the poem seeks its own shape, blah, blah, blah. And so, which it does, you know, it's true. So, but, you know, this, I was saying earlier that, you know, I used the quatrain, which is like the most despised stanza form, you know, nobody does it now. It's totally uncool, you know. And so I took this uncool form and then, but, you know, it does shock poem, right? As I said earlier in class, that you know, you put the phone book in quatrains, and people think it's a poem, right? But because it's really, it's the ballad, the hymn, it's what we recognize as a poem, so traditionally. So, and it was fun to work against that and make the poems as weird as possible against their orderly frame. You have that tension of good dog and order against weirdness, you know. So I enjoyed that kind of balance. Tension. We always talk about tension, right? Mm-hmm. So that's an element of tension, I guess. But they did scare me, though, because I didn't really know where they were coming from. Those God poems really scared me. But the voice poems were fun, because they were kind of like vaudeville, little vaudeville birds, you know. And I got to use language in those poems I don't usually use. In those, you know, those two arguing and stuff like that. So, yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah. This afternoon, we talked a little bit about writing the Book of Hours was done a lot in the woods and in Iowa. Can you just tell some of that?
Oh, yeah. A lot of the natural world comes in these poems a lot. You know, you heard the bird song one, and the little sparrow getting his neck broken. Yeah, I wrote a lot of them in the woods. I got a couple of residencies where I was actually in the woods and writing, and so, and I'm a birder anyway, I've done a lot of that anyway, but I also was an artist in residence for a while up at Isle Royale, which is the most isolated national park. The national parks do these artist in residence programs where you can apply, and if they take you, they give you a cabin somewhere in a beautiful spot, and then you're supposed to write stuff, and then you know, you give a couple of readings in the visitor center. They mainly want visual artists, of course. They want painters and stuff, but sometimes they put up with writers. So, and this place does. And nobody applies, because nobody even knows it exists. Isle Royale National Park. The most isolated, where would you imagine that would be? Probably Alaska, or people say, you know, oh, Wyoming, you know. But actually, it's an island in the middle of Lake Superior. And it's a 6-hour ferry ride from Houghton, Michigan, top of Michigan. So it's really isolated. And you have to bring all your own food. There's nothing there except the visitor center. There's no roads. There's no stores or anything. It's a big fancy hotel. But the rest of it is for backpackers, you know, for the 99%. but if you get this, that you get the cabin, it was a privately, you know, people had camps and stuff like that, and cabins on the island until the 30s, and then it turned into a state national park. But those cabins still exist, and one of them is the artisan residence cabin, the Dassler family cabin. So that is a really wonderful, you know, place. They built about 1912. That's about when all these cabins were built. And there's some cabins that are still lived in the summer because when they sold, you could sell outright your cabin to the National Park System, or you could sign a life lease and put everybody in the immediate family on that. And you put the one, you know, they would put like the 1 month old baby on there. And then when the last person on the lease dies, you know, the park comes in there and takes everything. So these 1 month old babies are now in their 80s and stuff, but they're still going up there every summer. And they're kind of great. I mean, two of them were put in charge of us. and they were given a motorboat for their trouble. And they would motor us around various kind of outer islands, and they were really fun. Betty and
Dick and Mary Schott.
Yeah, wait.
Dick and Mary
Schott. Mary Schott, right. So they were fun. Like, we had a walkie-talkie with them. There's no electricity or anything. Wow. And we'd turn on our mantelpiece, and we'd hear her say, "Hello, neighbors. Where do you want to go today? We can go after lunch to the cemetery island." You know? Okay, you know, so we hop in the motorboat, and she takes her. And you're given a canoe, and you can kind of muck about in the little islets, and stay away from the lake, though, which is really an ocean. I mean, it's a lot of shipwrecks and stuff like that. It's just an amazing body of water. But yeah, and so I wrote a number of them there. And so, you know, so that's a great thing that the national parks do. You know, I think there's a lot of people that apply the other ones because they know about them, like Denali up in Alaska, or Acadia in Maine, or, you know, Rocky Mountain, or, you know, Glacier. Those are huge places. And nobody goes to El Royal. You know, so the rangers are really happy. You know, they have to do almost no work. So it's just a great place. Any other questions? Yeah.
It seemed to me whenever I was reading some of your works that there was a sort of shift in it at some point in your career. Would you attribute any change in your work to having children that are maturing? It seems like it was probably around that time period that, like, whenever I was reading some of your work, that it changed a lot into a different kind of state of mind.
Well, I think only my first book was written without children. I think it's the greatest thing in the world to have a kid. I just want to stand on that. It's the most interesting thing. My husband and I always say to each other, it's really the best thing we ever did. It was so much fun, so interesting to raise. We only have one child, but it was terrific. It's so fascinating watching people come into language and, you know, and their interests become your interests, and it's just great. What can I say? And then they grow up and leave you. You know, tell them, right? But anyway, but I think for a writer, actually, it's very good because, you know, it's a real deepening experience. But then all kinds of experiences deepen. I suppose not having children is pretty deepening too. But yeah, I don't know exactly. It gives you more subject matter in a way. But it also projects you into the future in a lot of ways. In some ways, it's all about your kid, not you. And you have stuff you can talk about to your parents. You don't have to talk about you all the time. You can talk about the kid. So that's kind of a relief, really. Good. Don't talk about me. Let's So if you're thinking about having a child, do it. Eventually. Not this minute. Anybody else? No? Well, thank you for being so patient.